This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. The Mississippi River floods continue to inundate the Delta region. Tributaries are backing up, spilling record levels of water and leaving severe damage in its wake. Parts of the river were closed yesterday after three barges that were swept into a bridge by the swift current sank near Baton Rouge. The flooding is wreaking havoc on the region's economy. Communities that rely on the river for commerce and economic stability are suffering. Garrett Graves has been keeping watch on the river and the economic reverberations of the floods. He's chairman of the Louisiana Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority. He joins us from our member station WWNO in New Orleans. Thanks so much for being with us.
You bet. Thank you for the opportunity.
And what's the effect of slowing down the barge traffic?
Well, it's pretty incredible. This area is actually home to about 20% of the nation's maritime commerce. You're talking hundreds of billions of dollars in economic activity, everything from oil and gas and chemicals to products that are built and crops that are grown up in the Midwest. The Mississippi River is like America's commerce superhighway. 31 states have access to it. And it's a very, very efficient means of transportation. And so the impacts are profound throughout the economy. There was an analysis that was done a few years ago that indicated that every day of the river being shut down in Louisiana had about a $300 million economic impact.
Mm. This means that people going to their markets upriver will not be able to get certain foods they count on, that sort of thing?
That's exactly right. Everything from the grains and crops that are grown in the Midwest to that would be exported to other countries, to imports coming into the United States. The alternatives are trying to move some of this commerce to trucks and rail, but this nation just doesn't have the capacity to supplant the incredible tonnage that the Mississippi River is able to handle.
Are there people who are going to lose their livelihoods over this?
Well, in the state of Louisiana alone, we have about one in every seven jobs in our state that's tied back to the river system and the waterways here. We have five of the top 15 ports in the nation in South Louisiana, and much of that is tied back to the river. It's about 41% of the continental United States all comes and drains down in this area. So when you have this volume of water, it really does have extraordinary implications.
What are the environmental consequences of all this flooding?
The Chafalaya Basin, which is the area that the Morganza floodway is now sending hundreds of thousands of cubic feet of water into this area. In fact, I think it's about 120,000 cubic feet of water per second right now. This basin is one of the most productive in terms of ecology and wildlife. And what's happened is all this habitat, all this area is now underwater. And so you're seeing these herds of deer and bear and alligators and all these species that are now all in these small islands of land, all trying to get up and stay above the water. Mm. You're also seeing all the river with all the nutrients, the phosphates and the nitrates from farms in the Midwest that are coming down into this very ecological, productive and diverse basin that are now flooding into this area. And so there will be some impacts. This is very fertile farmland that's very, very important to this area and to the nation.
Mr. Graves, do you have a feeling for when the waters might begin to recede and moreover, when the region might begin to recover from some of the reverses?
On the Mississippi River Basin, we believe that we're seeing the highest level of water that we'll see for at least 10 days. And then we expect to see some slow decline, but they're telling us to expect higher than normal water levels for over a month.
Gary Graves, chairman of the Louisiana Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority, thanks so much.
You bet. Thank you.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Leanne Hansen. This week in Washington, policymakers will still be wrestling with the domestic economy and the twin burdens of the federal deficit and debt. Many Republicans are seizing on calls from Democrats to raise the nation's debt limit. Here's House Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan.
Like John Boehner said, for every dollar the president wants to raise the debt limit, we're saying cut at least a dollar's worth of spending, because that is the necessary thing to do to stave off a debt crisis.
In recent decades, the national debt has risen dramatically, and the tide of red ink seems to be carrying all other policy issues with it. NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving is in the studio. Hi, Ron.
Good to be with you, Leanne.
So this week, there was a significant moment in the debt struggle. We hit the limit. No more borrowing allowed, right?
In a sense, yes, at least for a period of time. What happened was that we hit the debt ceiling set by law, which was $14,294,000,000,000. We hit it right on schedule, as it were. And what didn't happen was that the market didn't crash and the Treasury said it would manage various accounts so as to keep afloat without new borrowing for a matter of about another 10 weeks. The idea is to give the White House and the Congress more time to negotiate a deal so that they can raise the limit again the way they've done nearly 100 times since World War I.
So they have until August. Are there negotiations going on?
Well, there are at least two sets of negotiations going on. One is the so-called Biden group led by the vice president, and he is meeting with Republican and Democratic leaders from Congress, from both the House and the Senate, and they're focused on the debt ceiling. And they'd like to get some kind of a deal by which the budget deficit would be reduced over the years to come by an amount that would be somewhat equivalent to the new increase in the debt ceiling. So we're talking hundreds of billions of dollars here when they really probably need to be talking trillions of dollars. But we may have a series of stopgaps where they do it in hundreds of billions and have to come back to it time and again. Now, that would keep the pressure on both sides to keep negotiating, but it might not be all that reassuring to the credit markets where the U.S. has to go to borrow money.
And what about the other group, the senators who had a bipartisan group looking into a long-term global deal on the deficit?
Yes, and a lot of us were holding out a good deal of hope and faith in that group. But this week, the so-called Gang of Six, three Republicans, three Democrats in the Senate, suffered a major blow, a perhaps crippling blow. They lost one of their members, Tom Coburn of Oklahoma, who said, well, the Democrats just weren't coming across with enough cuts, particularly in the Medicare program. And this Medicare issue, of course, has been enormously difficult for both parties. We've just seen in the last week what it did to Newt Gingrich, presidential candidate who got boxed up in talking about whether or not the plan that the House Republicans had passed, the Paul Ryan budget plan, was too radical, did too much social engineering, to use his phrase. And we saw what that did to his candidacy, and a wide swath of Republicans rose up to smite him for having talked like that about Paul Ryan. So Tom Coburn pulled out of this negotiation with the Democrats, saying the Democrats really had to own up to the difficulties with Medicare and the costs of Medicare in the long run. If he, Tom Coburn, were going to be willing to support any kind of tax increases at all, and that was the predicate of this entire Gang of Six, that there would be some tax increases to go with larger spending cuts.
We're going to talk more about Coburn's departure from the Gang of Six in a moment, but what is the Senate going to do with the Ryan budget, the one that the House sent over?
It looks like they're going to have a vote on it this week, and that does not make the Republicans happy because they know they're not going to have enough votes to pass it in the Senate, too many Democrats in the Senate, and they don't really want to have to vote on that budget and vote for these big changes in Medicare, making it a voucher and private insurance system. They don't want to vote on that if it's not going to happen, and yet they pretty much have to vote for it, especially after what they saw happen to Newt Gingrich last week. So it's a tough position for the Republicans to be in, and they would much rather have a vote on some kind of Democratic budget they could be against.
But what do the Republicans in the Senate want?
They would like the Democrats to do essentially what Paul Ryan has done in the House, come forward with something tough-minded, something politically unpopular. And in the case of what Kent Conrad and the other Democrats on the Senate Budget Committee would likely bring forward, that would probably include some unpopular tax cuts, mostly in discretionary spending rather than in entitlement programs like Medicare. And it would also include some kinds of tax increases, whether they were on corporations or on higher income individuals, some kind of revenue increases the Republicans would like to be able to vote against.
Do you see any hope on the horizon here?
This week, on Wednesday, there is a public event in town sponsored by the Peter Peterson Foundation. This is an anti-deficit outfit, private, informal group, and it is billed as the Fiscal Summit 2011. It will bring together the remaining Gang of Five from the Senate and also Paul Ryan, the man from the House, and also former President Bill Clinton. Now, he was the last president to actually bring forward a budget that had a projected balance and even surplus in the future. So if you still believe in a place called hope, you can stay tuned next week.
NPR senior Washington editor Ron Elving. Thanks a lot, Ron.
Good to be with you, Leanne.
Automaker Chrysler has announced plans to pay off its debt to the federal government. Chrysler owes about $7.5 billion to the United States and Canada for loans during the federal bailout 2 years ago. NPR's Sonari Glinton has more on the latest sign of the company's resurgence.
For a long time, when people talked about the American auto industry, there was General Motors, Ford, and, Chrysler. That began to change on Sunday, February 6, 2011, Super Bowl Sunday.
Now, we're from America, but this isn't New York City, or the Windy City, or Sin City, and we're certainly no one's Emerald City.
I think it's smart for Chrysler to draw upon that connection with Detroit, and using M&M is really a brilliant way to do that.
This is the Motor City. This is what we do.
Rick Wanchel is an analyst with Autotrader.com. He says Chrysler's brilliant marketing is really helping it to shrug off its stodgy image, even if it is with a middle-aged rapper.
M&M represents that swagger. You know, he represents the swagger of Detroit, the underdog quality of it, and rising above the troubles that that city has had.
Rachel says that swagger is only good if Chrysler has cars that people want to buy once they get into the showroom.
What's holding them back, in a way, is that they really don't have a signature vehicle that they can point to that symbolizes their resurgence.
General Motors has the Chevy Volt and the Cruze. Ford has the Fusion and the Focus. Those are all new, hip, fuel-efficient cars that use innovative technology. While Chrysler has updated almost all their cars, they haven't created a lot of brand new vehicles. David Champion is the head of auto testing at Consumer Reports. He says Chrysler has suffered from shifts in management and a lack of a single vision.
Now there is a direction that we have seen within Chrysler to produce really, really good cars.
Part of the direction comes from the Italian carmaker Fiat, which has an ownership stake. Champion says Chrysler is on the right track in terms of quality because years ago, when his friends and family would ask him about buying a Chrysler, he'd say,
"Don't even touch it with a barge pole." Nowadays, you'd say, "Well, the new 200, yes, it's a pretty nice car. You know, there's probably better ones out there, but yes, it's a consideration."
In the most recent Consumer Reports issue that grades the car makers on overall quality, Chrysler came in dead last among major automakers. Champion says that's not likely to happen again next year. And he says not being last would be a huge improvement for Chrysler. Sonari Glinton, NPR News.
This is NPR News. The last time the Mississippi River spilled over on the scale we're seeing today was nearly two decades ago. The Great Flood of 1993, as it came to be known, swept through the upper and middle Mississippi Valley from late June through mid-August. 52 people died, more than 1,000 levees failed, 70,000 people were displaced, and 15 million acres of farmland were inundated. Greg Gabrielson was among the many farmers who had to test his ingenuity against rising waters. He's taken a break from planting to speak with us from his home near Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Welcome to the program, Mr. Gabrielson.
Good morning.
Describe what happened on your land in 1993.
Well, I've got land close to the Rock River here, and that flooded three different times. We did get some planted, then it drowned it out. But what made the 93 so bad was even where the rivers weren't, it just kept raining, so we were unable to plant.
Wow. What did you do when you realized that your land was about to be flooded? I mean, was there anything you could do to protect your home and your farm?
No.
No.
No, you're pretty much at whatever nature is going to throw at you.
And so you just evacuated.
Well, the water came up close to our, it was actually on the grain bins and right up to the hog house I have, but I'm on a little knoll here. We were a little island. I couldn't get to the highway either direction, but it didn't get to the house.
But you did lose crops and acreage. How much did you lose?
Well, I had about 240 acres here that was all underwater.
Mm-hmm. And what crops would you plant there?
It was corn and soybeans.
And you lost the whole crop?
Basically, that year, yes. that year it kept raining and raining and raining.
Wow. How long did it take for your land to recover?
It recovered the next year.
Ah, so it took a year. Were these losses permanent?
No. We're kind of fortunate the way the river floods us. It fills up slow, and then it gradually goes over the road. And we don't have a lot of current with it, so it didn't do a lot of erosion. I would say the only long-term effect was we had to pick picnic tables up and tires and trees and pieces of plywood.
To get those fields clear of debris, not just the water.
Right, and then even the following year when I was combining in the fall, I ran a piece of plywood in the combine. How we could miss that, I don't know.
Do you have any advice for the farmers in the southern states that are facing these damaging floods?
Well, you just have to hope for a better year the next year. We're at the mercy of Mother Nature all the time. A hailstorm can come through and wipe us out in 30 seconds. You have to have a lot of faith to be a farmer. And my sympathy goes out for these people on the Mississippi River. It's when we think we've got it bad, we have no idea how bad it is when they're losing homes and property. I think between the tornadoes and the flooding, this is the worst natural disaster I think the United States has had.
Greg Gabrielson is a farmer near Sioux Falls, South Dakota. Thanks so much, and good luck with your crops this year.
Thank you.